I know that teachers are concerned and anxious to get back to in-person teaching.
School districts across the country are facing a hard decision, whether to reopen schools or not in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's a labor violation. Retaliate against someone expressing.
Medical personnel in California denounced lack of personal protective equipment on the job.
The policing that has always occurred on black and brown bodies in this country, and that's going back to the transatlantic slave trade. You're not a full human being, and I'm going to make sure that you're very clear on that.
And we hear from members of the People's Strike, a growing coalition of workers, community, and political organizations confronting the COVID-19 pandemic by struggling against inept and corrupt government and the forces of capital that put profit before the people and the planet. This and more on today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Tia Coakley.
I think we need to get the story straight because words are powerful.
Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis was laid to rest in Atlanta, Georgia. Reverend James Lawson spoke at the funeral.
Something else was happening to John in those early years. John saw the malignancy of racism in Troy, Alabama. There formed in him a sensibility that he had to do something about it. He did not know what that was. But he was convinced that he was called indeed to do whatever he could do, get in good trouble, but stop the horror that so many folk lived through and in this country in that part of the 20th century. John was not alone. Martin King had the same experience as a boy. I had the same experience from age 4 in the streets of Massillon, Ohio. Matthew McCullough, a pastor whose name you don't know in South Carolina, had the same experience. C.T. Vivian had the same experience. I maintain that many of us had no choice to do what we tried to do, primarily because at an early age, we recognize the wrong under which we were forced to live, and we swore to God that by God's grace, we would do whatever God called us to do in order to put on the table of the nation's agenda. This must end. Black lives matter. And so between 1953 and 1973, we had major campaigns year after year, thousands of demonstrations across the nation that supported it. We had folk in the Congress, folk in the White House, folks scattered across the United States who were beginning to formulate what the solutions are for change. The media makes a mistake when John is seen only in relationship to the Voting Rights Bill of 65. However important that is, you must not remember that in the 60s, Lyndon Johnson and the Congress of the United States passed the most advanced legislation on behalf of we, the people of the United States, that was ever passed. Head Start. Billions of dollars for housing. We would not be in the struggle we are today in housing if President Reagan hadn't cut that billions of dollars for housing, where local churches and local nonprofits could build affordable housing in their own communities, being sustained and financed by loans from the federal government. We passed Medicare. We passed anti-poverty programs, Civil Rights Bill 64, 65, voting rights bills, a whole array John Lewis must be understood as one of the leaders of the greatest advance of Congress and the White House on behalf of we, the people of the USA. We do not need bipartisan politics if we're going to celebrate the life of John Lewis. We need the Constitution to come alive. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We need the Congress and the presidents to work unfalteringly on behalf of every boy and every girl, so that every baby born on these shores will have access to the tree of life. That's the only way to honor John Robert Lewis. No other way. Let all of us in this service today, let all the people of the USA determine that we will not be quiet as long as any child dies in the first year of life in the United States. We will not be quiet as long as the largest poverty group in our nation are women and children. We will not be quiet as long as our nation continues to be the most violent culture in the history of humankind. We will not be quiet as long as our economy is shaped not by freedom, but by plantation capitalism that continues to cause domination and control rather than access and liberty and equality for all.
That was Reverend James Lawson speaking at the funeral of Congressman John Lewis. Protests continue across the country under the slogan of Black Lives Matter. Five anti-police violence activists, including civil rights icon Judge Faya Rose Touré, were recently arrested in Selma, Alabama. They were handcuffed, strip searched, and then put in orange suits in jail cells. Judge Touré spoke to Pacifica Radio's Dennis Bernstein.
I'm a part of an organization. As a matter of fact, I'm the coordinator of chairman of the Direct Action Committee of an organization of 40 organizations. It's a network called SOS, Movement for Justice and Democracy. And SOS stands for Saving Ourselves, because we certainly don't have a president or governor that will save us. And we have organized to actually focus on several issues. But one of the main issues is Medicaid for all. And we have a governor in Alabama who refuses to expand Medicaid that is costing the deaths of people of all races, but of certainly with this pandemic, the majority of people that are dying are Black and people of color. And it really amazes me, because she was on national TV talking about John Lewis, along with the mayor of Montgomery, who happens to be Black, the first Black mayor. Yet these people are not honoring what John Lewis and C.T. Vivian fought for and lived for and eventually died for. So this protest was especially important to me because of the death of these two giants. But to see these people on national TV praise them and talk about their work, and then to arrest us for a simple protest where we simply wrote into the street, Black Lives Matter, Medicaid for all. And that's why we were arrested. And we weren't arrested last Thursday during the protest. As a matter of fact, we were told we would not be arrested. But they waited to the weekend. And I really believe that the mayor of Alabama, who happens to be Black, first Black mayor, got pressure from some higher sources that encouraged him to arrest us. And three of us are over 70. And we had two young people that were arrested with us. But these are very trying times in Alabama. In the 60s, Alabama was at the forefront of the movement. C.T. Vivian and John Lewis, they were here with Dr. King and thousands of young people who fought for voting rights, who fought for human rights. And it saddens me greatly that because of their sacrifice, we got Black mayors. We got black jurors. We got black police officers. But I was nearly brought to tears in that jail today when black women strip searched me. I'm 75 years old. Put handcuffs on me. In the back when I said, look, my wrist has been broken, put the handcuffs in my front, refused to do it. That was the heartbreaking thing about this experience with me today. And I thought about the thousands of incarcerated people who live under these conditions year after year. I was only there for 4 or 5 hours, but my heart goes out to people who have to suffer in these jails that are inhumane. So I am encouraged more than ever to fight and prove to our own people that your lives matter.
Judge Faya Rose Touré speaking to Pacifica Radio. We thank Dennis Bernstein from KPFA in Berkeley, California, for sharing this interview.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, legendary Amiri Baraka.
This is an excerpt from a poem called Why Is We Americans? But reality is an excerpt on television. Why is we Americans? Why is we Americans? Boo-dee-da. 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 Boo-doo-doo. Be-dee-dee-dee. Boo-dee-boo-dee-boo-boo-boo. What I want is me, for real. I want me and myself, and what that is what I be and what I see and feel, and who is me and the what it is and who it is and when it me is what it be. I'm going to be here if I want, like I said, self-determination. But I ain't come from a foolish tribe. We wants the mule, the land. You can make it 300 years of blue chip stock in the entire operation. We want to be paid in a central bank, the average worker, farmer wage for all those years we gave it free. Plus, we want damages for all the killings and the fraud, the lynchings, the missing justice, the lies and frame-ups, the unwarranted jailings, the tar and featherings, the character and race assassinations, historical slander, ugly caricatures. For every Sambo, step and fetch it flick, we want to be paid. For every hurtful thing you did or said, for all the land you took, for all the rapes, all the rosewoods and black Wall Street you destroyed, all the miseducation, jobs lost, segregated shacks we lived in, the disease that ate and killed us, for all the mad police that drilled us, for all the music and dances you stole, the styles, the language, the hip clothes you copped, the careers you stopped. All these are suits. Specific litigation as represent we, be like we, for reparations for damages paid to the Afro-American nation. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da. We want education for all of us and anyone else in the black pelt hurt by slavery, for all the native peoples, even them poor white people you show all the time as funny, all them Abners and Daisy Mays, them Beverly Hillbillies who never got to know Beverly Hills, who never got to Harvard on their grandfather's wills. We want reparations for them, right on, for the Mexicans whose land you stole, for all of North Mexico, you call it Texas, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all that, all that, all that, all that. Be-dee-da, doo-doo. All that you got to give.
That was poet Amiri Baraka.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
This is Pacifica Radio's special broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Tia Coatley. Medical personnel treating coronavirus patients in California denounce lack of personal protective equipment on the job. Steve Zeltzer has the details.
In Alameda County, the Board of Supervisors voted to hand over the Alameda County Hospitals to a private corporation, AHS. Shalika Carter, who is a union activist and healthcare worker, talks about the effect of this privatization in the midst of this pandemic.
We just recently had
an issue in our inpatient with a nurse who expressed his concern about the fact that there was a lack of PPE that was brought up to the Board of Supervisors, and he was eventually let go.
You're saying that many workers are fearful that they're going to get sick or they're going to contaminate their families and the public if they don't have the proper PPE.
That's correct. And it's happening now. We've had instances where workers have come in direct contact with a worker who actually tested positive for COVID and weren't notified by their direct supervisors, and there's no alerts going out. They're actually deferring the worker back to their workspace and not implementing any safety measures after that person has been exposed. They've decided to seek services from third-party contract vendor systems where they have personal relationships with, and then these managers bring in these third-party contractors based on their personal relationships that they brought in with them to cover services that the hospital should be able to manage on their own. And so it's a waste of money. It's a waste of money being spent. And in the meantime, they're laying off workers that have been there for over 15 and 20 years who have relationships, vested interests in the communities that they serve. But that's why we're asking for the County Board of Supervisors to step in so that we can start overseeing the workers and the people in the community. Two-thirds of our workforce are Black and brown. 83% of our patients are Black and brown. There is a system of, I feel like the slave owner and the slave plantation happening right now, where if the field slave speaks out, he gets lashed in the back, And I feel like the Board of Supervisors aren't doing what they need to do. I think legally they do need to be held accountable for not protecting their workers during COVID, pre-COVID, and then basically threatening workers if they talk about or tell other people about the conditions that they're working in. I don't see how that's able to happen, but it is. Every one of our CEOs has been a Black man, mostly. But best believe they are not the ones running the show. And I believe that they are for show. And they're a party to this sort of culture as well. And they're letting their managers, they're letting their higher leadership inflict these, I call them atrocities, on their workers and the patients. They are abusing their workers, and their workers aren't equipped to help the patients that need us the most.
Shalika Carter, who is a union activist and healthcare worker.
Our thanks to Pacifica producer Steve Zeltzer for this report. In the United States, the number of deaths from COVID-19 exceeded 155,000 last week. Early on, New York City had the misfortune of being the epicenter in the United States. Knowledge gained by the dedicated doctors and other healthcare workers has helped increase understanding of the disease. Overcoming early safety concerns around doing autopsies on COVID patients, Mount Sinai's findings have aided in establishing protocols based on the best science available. Akua Holt of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, 90.1 FM, spoke with Dr. Mary E. Folks, Director of Neuropathology and Autopsy Services at Mount Sinai Hospital, New York City.
We weren't sure whether or not we would be safe doing the autopsies. That was one of the biggest problems. There were only four of us that were actually willing to take the risk, feeling that it was critically important to actually do autopsies, because autopsies do uncover findings that are not expected. And this is just an unbelievable example of that. When you have a new disease and you suspect things, but you're finding some clinical features that are a little unusual, then doing an autopsy is extremely helpful. We did expect to see lung disease, but we did not expect to see thrombi, blood clots, all over the place. When the hospital started setting up tents in Central Park because of the need for overflow for patients with COVID, I personally talked to the clinicians that were in charge of setting up the tents and made sure that they had laboratory tests available for all the coagulation studies. Blood clots are part of a coagulation mechanism. If there's an abnormality in coagulation, it can either cause a blood clot or it can cause bleeding. In these cases, it's causing blood clots. So the hospital implemented a COVID coagulation protocol, and the remaining 83 cases of autopsies that we did, we only had one additional pulmonary embolus. So having autopsies, uncovering findings, is very helpful for the clinicians as long as you end up having a continuous dialogue with the clinicians. We also found that there was at least one case where we suspected that hydroxychloroquine, which had been administered to the patient, probably contributed to his death. So again, when the tent facility was, we would have morning conferences about how to treat the patients, what was needed, what was happening. And they raised the question about whether or not hydroxychloroquine should be continued as a clinical trial for treatment of the severely ill patients. And I told them that we had at least one case where hydroxychloroquine was expected to have contributed to the death. Now, I'm not sure if they then canceled the clinical trial or not, but it's just one more piece of information that's very useful for the clinicians for treating the live patients. What was so surprising was the number of strokes and infarcts in the brain. We found about 35% of patients. So to date, now, we have done 100 autopsies on COVID patients. 35 or 36% of the cases have infarcts, have strokes, either large strokes, patchy strokes, or small, small microthrombi, small blood vessels. And they're scattered variably throughout the brain. And that was unexpected. We have one case where there were small little punctate hemorrhages in the white matter of the brain. And under the microscope, those small punctate regions had changes in the myelin sheath, the white matter coating of the axons of the neurons in the brain. And there is a disorder called ADEM, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, or the acute phase is acute hemorrhagic leukoencephalopathy. ADEM is thought to be due to an acute viral illness. It usually occurs in young people or in adolescents. And the patient that actually had this presentation was a young adult. And it typically can occur either because of a virus or because of vaccinations. It's a fairly rare event, but it has been reported once already. So it could potentially explain some of the central nervous system abnormalities, but clearly these small little strokes also can explain some of the central nervous system abnormalities that patients are having. They're having confusion. It doesn't necessarily explain the loss of sense of smell, but we have found virus in the blood vessels in the brain, in the endothelial cells. So it's the cells lining the inside of blood vessels. We've found virus in the spleen, in the lymph nodes, in the lung, and in the kidney. We know they've got pneumonia, viral pneumonia, but a lot of these patients also developed secondary bacterial infections, bacterial pneumonia as well. Well, so in the lung, at least, there is a bacterial infection in some of the patients. They're getting a bacterial infection on top of the viral infection in the lungs. That's important to know because bacterial infections you can treat with antibiotics. Viral infections you can't. We know that the people that are most at risk of dying from COVID are those patients that have hypertension, heart disease, obesity with diabetes. Now, obesity and diabetes affect the vasculature, affect the heart. And so knowing that the vascular system is involved by this virus may explain why it has prolonged effect on the patients that come down with COVID, that it's not simply clearing the infection from the lungs, that this virus may have the ability to hide a little bit.
So does heat have anything to do with this? I've also read it depends on the viral load. If you live in a place where you have to walk through a hallway and someone coughs, that if the viral load is very high, it can linger in the air for hours. So help us understand this. Can you answer that for us?
Well, we know that the virus, if you cough, if you are talking, if you're talking loud, if you are even asymptomatic or you are symptomatic and you don't have a mask, the virus can go more than 6 feet. If you're singing, if you're coughing, large particles can travel quite a distance. So even if it's hot, if you're close to somebody that is not wearing a mask and they have the virus, even if they're asymptomatic, they can spread those virus particles to you. If you're not wearing a mask, you can breathe them in. So it doesn't matter how hot it is.
That was Dr. Mary Folks, Director of Neuropathology and Autopsy Services at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, in conversation with Akua Holtz of Pacifica Radio, KPFT in Houston, Texas. Many thanks to producer Lona Elias of WPFW in Washington, D.C. People's Strike is a growing coalition of workers, community, and political organizations confronting the COVID-19 pandemic by struggling against inept and corrupt government and the forces of capital, such as banks and corporations, that put profit before the people and the planet. During their monthly broadcast, they brought together a group of educators, parents, and concerned citizens to address the issue of education. Matt Meyer of the People's Strike shared this conversation with Pacifica Radio.
This is Matt Meyer for People's Strike Broadcast. Excited now to have three of the most dedicated educators and social change leaders from three key cities, Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago. Really excited to introduce Melina Abdullah, Bernard Gassaway, and Marvin Garcia, three people I'm honored to call friends. Melina Abdullah is professor and former chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles. She's a national leader of Black Lives Matter and a co-founder of BLM's LA chapter. A self-described womanist, scholar, activist, Abdullah is co-host and co-producer of Pacifica Radio, KPFK's weekly program, Beautiful Struggle. A beautiful friend and leader, Melina Abdullah. Bernard Gassaway is an award-winning and distinguished educator, author of Education Denied, Children, Challenges, Choices, and many other books. He's the former principal of Brooklyn's notorious Boys and Girls High School and former senior superintendent of New York City Alternative High Schools and Programs, where I used to work. He's my former boss. He's also a former student of one of the more notorious schools in New York City. And coming up from there to becoming a Columbia University Revson Fellow and lifelong community advocate, he writes that his most cherished role is that of being a father. And finally, Marvin Garcia cut his teeth as teacher and principal in Chicago's independent Pedro Albizu Campos High School, deeply rooted in the Puerto Rican community there. Never leaving that community, Garcia has served as director of the Praxis Project, of the National Alternative Schools Network. He's a leader of the Community as Campus Community Action Council for the Chicago Public Schools, and is currently a member of the Board of Trustees of Northeastern Illinois University. Welcome. You are leaders on a national scale throughout the empire, on an international scale, but more than just certainly reform and more than just protest movements, you've also been deeply involved in building alternatives. What is that going to mean in this period? What are the kinds of alternatives that we can build in this moment?
I think that there's lots of alternatives that we can build. I think that the first step is stepping back and making sure we engage our radical imaginations and think about what kind of world we want to live in, and then how does that play out in terms of systems, right? So when we say defund the police, we also couple that call, that clarion call, with reimagining public safety. We know that more than 90% of calls to police are not violent calls, not calls about immediate threats to violence. And even those that are around questions of so-called violent crime, they're usually around responses, not ways of intervening. So it's, you know, if someone calls, it's usually because if it's a violent call, they've been sexually assaulted or they've been robbed. Not that, you know, they're asking for police to intervene in the midst of a robbery or an assault, right? So when we talk about reimagining, we need to really think about what it is we're looking for in terms of public safety. And the priorities that we've seen in Los Angeles, Black Lives Matter has led an effort called People's Budget LA, pulling our money out of police, right? So in Los Angeles, the mayor proposed spending 54% of our city's general fund on LAPD. And, you know, if we think about your city, Chicago and New York, those numbers aren't that far off. And, you know, we say that that's an misuse of funds. We don't need to be spending that kind of money, $3.15 billion on LAPD, and that's just, you know, a portion of what they propose to spend. That's just the general fund portion, right? And so what it looks like for us is saying, what else could we do with $3.15 billion? We could invest it in meeting the universal needs of people, right? Making sure that everybody has housing and health care and good jobs and that there's quality after school programs. We could make sure that we have a built environment, like, you know, safe parks with programs that are, you know, resourced by youth workers, not patrolled by police. We could have libraries, right? We could have a safe environment, a clean environment, right? And then when we do get to questions of, you know, safety, we can engage in a transformative justice model, right? Where we center on, you know, what survivors need in order to recover from whatever it is they've experienced. So how do we make sure that they have mental health resources? How do we make sure that they have, that there's trauma-informed care, right? And then how do we get to questions of restitution and repair, right? We also need to think about what it is we can do to prevent folks from engaging in violent acts or in so-called criminal acts in the first place. So how do we, I think about cities like Newark, New Jersey, where the mayor there, Raz Baraka, who's one of the most visionary mayors in this country, right, has said, let me pull some dollars out of police and invest it in what he calls community care teams community care teams that anticipate needs of communities, but also intervene, right? These are often, you know, people who society has criminalized, but who neighborhoods might revere, right? Who are going in and saying, you know, this is how we prevent altercations and violence. This is where we invest. And so as we think about alternatives, I think that these are really, they're imaginative, but they're also common sense, right? It's common sense that we don't deploy police because someone has a broken taillight, right? There are countries in this world that have departments of transportation and will absolutely pull someone over for having a broken taillight. But then what do? They fix the damn taillight, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's common sense that if someone is having a mental health challenge, that they don't need people assaulting them and pushing them into a corner with guns drawn, right? What is that going to do to their mental health, right? And so it's really important that we invest in the things that communities actually need. In terms of education, one of the things we've been pushing is a complete divestment from police in schools, no more school police, and also a severing of ties from police. There is not one incident that we know of where police have actually kept that kept school communities safer. We know that the ones who actually jump in when there's a fight on campus, and you all can hopefully co-sign, is the teachers, is the staff, is the, you know, sometimes the parents, right? Or other children, right? That's who actually intervenes and calms down questions of, you know, conflict. And we also have to remember that in our schools, our children are children. And children will do what children do, and we have to always treat them as children. And I'm speaking not only as an educator, but as the mother of three public school children, two of whom had the police called on them in school for things that are not crimes. One had the police called on her for having slime in her pocket. That is not a crime. And police should not be called because an 11-year-old has slime. Every sixth grader has slime. It's not a big deal, right? And so these are the things that we need to think about. And then finally, what we're ushering in beyond making schools spaces of abolition, and by schools, I mean both K through 12, but also universities, is thinking about how to build freedom campuses. How do we make schools sites for care for our young people, you know, safe spaces for our young people. And we see that as, you know, no police on campus. We see that as making them open and accessible and safe havens for our young people. And we also see that as investment in ethnic studies, which is, you know, the discipline that actually validates and one of the only ones that is proven to have increased the connectivity between children and students and their educational processes.
I'll just follow up with you. When you talk about reimagining schools, because there's a big push for that, we also talk about defunding police and somewhat reinvesting that money into schools. I advocate at this point to not necessarily to reinvest funds into the public school system, particularly the public school system in New York City, because if the public school system, let's say, were a plantation, which is probably not far from that, when we reimagine what schools should be, what we're actually doing is going to the plantation owner and telling him or her what our ideas are, and then that owner is going to still do what he or she wants to do that's going to be in the best interest of the plantation, not necessarily in the best interest of the children. So until we can reimagine a school system where we have total ownership, then I can see us investing in it. For example, there's a great amount of the funds that go into public schools are going to national book publishers. And these book publishers are publishing textbooks that are furthering the notion, the ideology of white supremacy. And these are the books that our children are being given. These are the books that our children are being told to read. I see an immediate action would be to divest, not only from police, but divest from these corporations, such as the Pearsons of the world and the Huffman, Michelin, all the other book companies that are profiting off of the backs of our children. So reimagining for me takes on a totally different look. Even schooling, as I said earlier, I decided to homeschool my daughter because we did not want to get into a position where we would have to unschool her. There's a whole another movement where you taught lies, so now we got to reverse those lies in terms of that. So the school system or schools that I can imagine would be truly run and owned by the communities and operated by the communities. Sort of like what Marvin mentioned when he talks about, when he was sharing with me about the community as a campus concept or something similar to that. But we not only control the curriculum, but we also control the funding that goes, and we control who's actually teaching our children. Okay, because you can have the best curriculum in the world right now, but if people who resort to their mental model, because that's what happens, you can train people all you want, but ultimately they're going to go back to their default mental model where they see that black child that's sitting in front of them or that Latino child sitting in front of them as less than human. All right, in some cases they can't even relate and don't care to relate to the people who are sitting in front of them because they're protected in some cases by teachers unions who really, and from my experience, they represent the interests of the adults, not the interests of children.
If we were to defund the police and defund the Pentagon, I believe, for my community, we could expand pre-K. We could put people in our community in teacher training programs, in principal programs. We could have people that work in institutions of education in our community investing in our community. They live in our community, they get a salary, and they spend their money in our community. What's happening now is people from outside of our community that don't know our community, don't relate to our community, are getting a paycheck and then we're building their community. So I think that's critical. We have to strengthen our neighborhood schools. We have to have options. We have to eliminate the private schools that are getting public dollars and going into pockets of individuals. So we have to eliminate these profiteering schools. We have to have high schools that provide different career paths for students. Not everybody's going to go into a four-year liberal arts education. Not everybody's going to go to city colleges and get into a program there. Not everybody's going to get into a trades program. So we got to build our schools around what are the interests of the students and their careers. I also believe at the university level, state universities should defund, get rid of their police and their police departments. At Northeastern Illinois University, we have like a $2.2 million budget for the police, $500,000 for any kind of supportive services for our students. So universities get two pots of money. They get money from the state, they get an allocation, then they charge tuition. We don't need to charge tuition. If we were to defund the police, defund the Pentagon, there's so much that we could do. Therefore, we will not see students in debt until they're 50 years old. We don't need that. What we need is for people to live their lives and commit to their communities and develop their communities. But we're not allowing that to happen. We're not allowing for communities to fully develop as institutions or places where people can actually self-actualize their full potential.
We thank the People's Strike and Matt Meyer for sharing their recordings with Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. We now hear from Elizabeth Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, in conversation with Thomas O'Rourke, a member of the union and a contributor to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, with Esther Averam.
Teachers are amazing. And I don't want any messaging out there that teachers are trying to shirk their responsibility for returning to schools. Teachers began expressing concern about their students before we closed the schools. I began receiving calls from counselors and teachers about, Liz, what are we going to do about the students who may not have computers if we close? How do we reach them? How are they going to have Wi-Fi? Those concerns were raised by teachers before the schools were closed. So I know that teachers are concerned and anxious to get back to in-person teaching. They're the first to say that nothing can replace in-person teaching. The socializing, engaging with their students, they want to do that. But top priority for them, and it ought to be for everybody, is safety first. Safety first. We do not want to put anyone, students, teachers, or families, at risk with information or without information and for them not to know what to expect, but to simply trust the system for opening the right way. I'm just not comfortable with it. And I want, teachers are supportive. We're waiting for Chancellor Furby and D.C. Public Schools to say, let's work together to make this work. And that has not happened. But we're going to have to shift directions and begin to make that happen.
You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
From the San Francisco Bay Area, Poor People's News Hour offers this piece on how language can be used as a tool of domination and how some folks are instead making it into a vehicle for collective liberation. Here's the Poor People's Magazine Collective.
Sorted, separated, segregated, occupied, intimidated, silenced before we speak, teach, or write? Because we walk in tongues considered dumb, not right, not proper, and therefore permanently kept an outsider. They call it linguistics. We built our own language. Y'all missed it. So that's a little excerpt from the opening poem from Linguistic Domination, Language Supremacy, and the Myth of Illiteracy, which is actually the ways that poor folks, youth of color, children, indigenous children, are silenced in these institutional schools and intentionally kept outside of these channels of access. So my brother Mutiado and myself are going to read just a little bit from the chapter, Linguistic Domination.
From GED to the New York Times, linguistic domination is used to exclude, shame and silence, segregate, disempower, and destroys voices speaking indigenous languages. Meanwhile, proficiency in the colonizers' tongues affords access, space, resources, and power to a much smaller group of people with race, class, and or educational privilege. Across Pachamama, Mother Earth, linguistic domination has aided and abated the colonization efforts of missionary, social workers, service providers, academics, and media makers. The teaching of the man's language was integral to the so-called civilizing of indigenous people across the globe, from Turtle Island, North America, to Australia. Before Spanish colonization, many different indigenous groups, including Lenca, Maya, Chorti, Maya, Pocoman, Cacapuera, Nahua, Pipil, lived in what is now El Salvador. Today, almost all of the indigenous people in El Salvador speak only Spanish. Not many Lenca who live in the eastern El Salvador and western Honduras still speak their traditional language, Poto Lenca. Though a few of texts of this language have been published, Spanish colonizers not only violently seized the control of the land of the Lenca, who live on the set-up systems that exploited both land and people. They also decimated the indigenous language and culture. Over centuries of a horrific colonial violence, indigenous people feared that they would lose their lives if they spoke their traditional language or maintained indigenous customs. To survive, many began speaking the colonizers' language and practicing Catholicism, restricting traditional practice to the privacy of their homes.
The near complete destruction of indigenous people's native tongues enabled the colonizers' sanitized lies to be perpetrated on generations of children. It allowed young people to be sorted and separated and forced to learn the colonizers' histories and languages. Finally, excellence in the colonizers' tongue became the only barometer for success, as well as dire survival technique. However, the Lenca have maintained the memory of their pre-colonial histories and herstories and their resistance to the Spanish through oral tradition. They have instituted programs with universities and community councils to preserve and promote their heritage, history, health, and human rights, as reported by Minority Rights Group International. The Lenca have even claimed a slice of the airwaves in western Honduras with a high-power AM station called La Voz Lenca. For peoples of color in the U.S. and indigenous peoples from other parts of Pachamama who have migrated to the U.S. due to imperialist wars, globalization, or theft of land and resources and subsequent poverty, linguistic domination plays out in the demand that all peoples must speak the one language of the English-speaking colonizer. The next reader you'll hear is D. Allen.
The English language is used as a way to weed out all but a few students who can master not only the master's language, but the dominant way of thinking and living. The English language domination is implemented both covertly and overtly through language testing, curriculum development, English-only mandates in schools, and racist laws such as Arizona's SB 1070, which includes the demand that all peoples must speak the language of the colonizer and nothing else. When the No Child Left Behind Act became law in 2002, mandatory standardized testing of all public school students was codified into U.S. federal law, locking into place a deadly obstacle for Poe children and children from all cultures that don't speak, think, or act like the people who write these tests and shape these laws. These institutionalized forms of silencing dictate what and whose words and information is considered legitimate, who and what is funded to create media, and who is considered an expert, a media maker, and a communicator. Linguistic domination is full of oppressive processes of defining literacy and naming the correct language, and who speaks it right, who understands it completely, and has the skills to teach on it. Reeling from the realization of this violence and destruction, I began to teach on the idea of linguistic domination, a concept that I started developing while working on racial justice and education policy at an organization called Justice Matters. It was the only formal JOB this poverty scholar ever held, and within it, I witnessed the impact and fallout of linguistic domination in U.S. schools. I began researching the original theft from indigenous peoples of their native alphabets and dictionaries. I reached out to other indigenous scholars and community members to find out what, if any, active resistance to this domination that was occurring on Turtle Island. As I researched, I discovered there weren't a lot of post-colonial communities doing this as part of a public curriculum of academically documented process, but resistance is happening, both at the formal slash institutional level and more informally at the grassroots levels in communities, in pop culture, and elsewhere.
Beautiful. And so again, that was from the chapter Linguistic Domination, from Poverty Scholarship, Poor People Led Theory, Art, Words, and Tears Across Mama Earth. And like us poverty scholars say, poverty scholarship is theory, and theory is our life.
We would like to thank Poor People's Magazine for sharing this story. You can follow their work at poormagazine.org. This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates for contributing to this and other editions of the show. Today's show was produced by Paulina Basilia. I'm your host, Tia Coakley. You can find all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.